Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Merchants, you know, you're crazy. You can't survive. I don't know how many times I heard that. Since I didn't look at it as a business, I didn't care. And they proved to be wrong anyway. Out of no background at all in really fine wine or fine dining, here I am with Richard Olney and Alice Waters and Aubert de Villene from Romane Conti and Hubert de Monti, who kind of changed the way people make red Burgundy. You know, there I was. I mean, it's crazy. What luck.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org proudly presents Evolutionaries, Kermit Lynch. 40 years ago, Kermit Lynch seemed like an unlikely wine hero. A struggling musician with a fledging handbag business, no one, least of all himself, would have predicted his groundbreaking future as a wine importer and retailer in Berkeley, California. The American wine drinking landscape has forever been changed by his work. Kermit is the recipient of 2 James Beard Awards and was knighted by the French government with their prestigious Légion d'Honneur. In 1988, Kermit wrote Adventures on the Wine Route, which many consider to be the best wine book on the business. This is his story.
When I was 9, my mother left my father and, thank goodness, took me with her. She married a fellow who liked the high life like she did, a lot of going out to bars and clubs, dancing and movies and whatever, everything was permitted. That's when I started to drink wine. It was always with a meal. And when I left and went to college, I continued. I didn't have much money, but I'd buy a jug, make it last a few days. I was a pain in the ass in high school. I got into a lot of trouble, and one of their punishments was to lower all my grades 1 point so that I couldn't get into Cal. So I got into Fresno State and proceeded to flunk out. I still couldn't get into Cal, worse than ever, having flunked out of Fresno State, but it's the best thing that could have happened because I got into San Francisco State and discovered this whole world I didn't know anything about. By then, you know, the drug days had started, the sexual revolution, all that, and I wrote some piece for my 3 classes in the graduate school, and I handed in the same piece to the 3 for the 3 classes, and I got an A, a B, and a D. And if you get a D, you're out of the master's program, so that ended my education. So those days in Berkeley, as everybody knows, they sort of became famous, the 60s in Berkeley. And I took part in all that, and I hated to work. I'd worked ever since I was being driven around in a van at about 6 years old trying to sell donuts door to door. I never got money from my family. I'd worked as a shoe salesman. I'd worked selling men's clothes, on and on. I mean, and I just hated it all. I wanted to live without a rotten job, which, of course, is pretty hard to pull off. The luxuries for me in those days was being able to buy cat food for my cat and a jug of wine so that I could have a glass of wine with my meals. I was living in a closet, practically. But I was writing for an underground newspaper. I was writing music reviews, and those were the days like when the Stones came and performed at Altamont and etc. It was the heyday for rock and roll. I wasn't much of a druggie. I was really lucky because I was in a band playing gigs live, and you know, an electric band, rock and roll band, and the lead guitarist was a LSD dealer and developed a cocaine habit, and so cocaine was all over in the music world then. It was the great kick was to snort cocaine and drink tequila. Somehow those two were like Muscadet and oysters or something. You know, it was the marriage. And I was lucky because snorting cocaine gave me nosebleeds. I couldn't do it physically. And LSD, that's one of the first, I think I'd only smoked grass once or twice before having LSD. And it was sold to us by this friend who, you know, we said, can you get us some marijuana? Because a professor had turned us on to smoking grass. And, you know, those first times you get stoned, it's like hilarious. You're just rolling on the floor. It's so cool. That didn't last long, you know. But anyway, so I'd had marijuana once or twice. And she said, the friend says, oh, no, I couldn't get you that, but this is just like it. It's called LSD. So, again, we had no idea that we'd take LSD. That was the real thing, and we went to outer space. Every dimension changed. The walls became fluid. So did we. This is so stupid what we were doing.
While struggling as a musician, Kermit was making ends meet with a small handbag operation. Much to his surprise, somebody wanted to buy his small business, and with the proceeds, Kermit took what would be a transformative trip to Europe.
So I went to Europe for 4 months for the first time, me and my girlfriend, and it was so cool because her mother ordered a car, a European car, and so we picked it up and had a free car all driving around Europe and then dropped it off at Le Havre to ship it back to her mother. That was one of the great things that happened. But that was my introduction to France, for example, but I also went to Spain and spent a little time in Austria. Sort of like Alice Waters talks about the revelation, it wasn't quite like that to me. I already was into the culture of wine drinking with meals. What I noticed was how well one ate in those days. That's been one of the stories of my careers. When I started going over to France and Spain, Austria, just about anywhere you ate was wonderful compared to what we were eating in this country. I didn't know anything about fine dining. I'd never cooked. My mother didn't cook. You know, it was a TV dinner at our house. She thought that was the biggest progress in history of mankind. No more cooking. So the quality of the food was a revelation. And I remember we'd met another couple we knew and from Berkeley there in Barcelona. And we ate at one of the fish restaurants and we saw some neighbors eating clams on the half shell. So we ordered them, and when they came, you know, they have the lemon slices, and when we squeezed the lemon, all the clams started writhing on their shell, you know. And we, the girls were, my God! And we didn't eat them. So that's the stage we were at.
Kermit's trip to Europe accelerated his interest in wine, and with a loan from his girlfriend, he opened a small wine shop in Albany, California. The timing couldn't have been better.
Well, nobody knew anything about me. I didn't know anything about me in terms of doing business. It was going to be a hobby. It wasn't going to be a real business. The way things happened, I was so lucky. I hate to say I took advantage of a real catastrophic period for wines. While I was trying to find a job in the wine business, nobody would hire me. They were all firing because there was this total recession in the wine world. People just stopped buying fine wines. It was considered like a luxury item. And I was the only one, I just started when I opened my store, who didn't have tons of expensive stock that they were trying to unload. And the three big wine dealers in Berkeley, there were three really fine shops. People would come from all over the Bay Area to get at their collections. They went out of business. They didn't survive that recession. And since I was just going into it, I was able to profit from all the dumping that was going on. And this deal with this importer, which allowed me to return wine, I didn't have to worry about having an inventory, which was lucky because I really had no money.
Kermit made a name for himself by advertising that he'd personally tasted every wine sold in his shop. He sent descriptive newsletters out that included detailed stories, tasting notes, and anecdotes that gave potential buyers firsthand insight into the obscure wines and regions they were being made in. Kermit developed relationships with wineries that are considered some of the best in the world and created an enormous legacy as an importer of terroir-driven wine.
This relationship I had, I'd been buying tons of wines from Frank Schoonmaker Selections. Now that was what set my business on fire, were not my own selections. I hadn't really gotten into that much. One day I got in the mail a huge catalog, like a phone book of Frank Schoonmaker wines, and they were all discounted because of that wine recession I mentioned. Unbelievably discounted. I'd been selling Echezo for about $60 a bottle. If I bought it from Frank Schoonmaker, and he had a good domain, Montgillard Munieret was an excellent domain in those days, I could retail it for $6, $6, $7 a bottle. All the wines were still in Europe. They weren't here. No one could sample them. I was going to Europe to taste the wines, and nobody else was. But it meant visiting all the domains. So that was an education right there. And then I knew what was in the bottles of all these cheap, cheap, great wines. Chambertin Clos de Bez, I was selling for $8.95 a bottle. Well, people started flocking to me. I got a huge, that's how I formed my structure and everything for sales and started writing the brochure, describing wines instead of just listing them. Meanwhile, I was finding my own wines. The guy who imported Frank Schoonmaker Selections, Karl Petrowski was his name, he kindly let me piggyback my wines in his containers. It was so generous of him because, in a way, I was his client, but I was building a business to compete with him. You know? Then once I was doing enough business, I could pay for my own container. In bringing those wines in, that's when I noticed that they weren't tasting quite as good here as they were in the cellars. So I spent a large part of my career trying to correct that. It wasn't easy. People say, oh, you just order a 20-foot refrigerated container. Listen, you don't know. That's the reason I have my office in France, is to try to get those wines from the cellar door to my door refrigerated. It was almost impossible. I think we've just achieved that. That means a staff in place over there.
Kermit tells it like he sees it and has strong opinions based on years of experience and little patience for dogmatic or trendy approaches to wine.
I've been served red wine so warm in places where they don't have an ice bucket, I'll put ice cubes in my red wine. And I've shocked some French restaurateurs that way, but I'll tell you, they bring a wine out at, like, you know, 85 degree temperature, the room temperature, restaurant temperature in the summer, and expect me to drink that wine. They're crazy. And that's what I tell them when they treat me like the ugly American, you know. It's astonishing, the lack of wine knowledge in France, you know, in restaurants. That sounds like maybe I'm a fanatic. I'm not at all. I'm just practical. This idea of drinking red wines at room temperature came from the old days in England, especially, where you would bring the wine up from this icy, cold cellar. It was almost frozen. You'd bring it up, and of course, your house, there's a fireplace, but that's it. So, yeah, you'd bring it up to their cold room temperature. You wouldn't bring it up to 80, 90 degrees, you know. You just have to think about that a little. But what I'm saying is, yeah, a white wine should be fairly cold, not too, but a red wine, feel it with your hand. If it's cool, then it's a good temperature. You don't have to measure it with a thermometer. I think natural wine people have become a little bit like Deutschland über alles. It's natural wine über alles, and it's like no matter what's in the bottle, they're going to drink it because they're told it's a natural wine. And for natural wine people, I'd like to say, look at my experience with filtration and you might learn something. Then I went through that with SO2, you know, the battles with sulfured wines too. And all these, I have a certain experience with the same wine, sulfured, unsulfured, filtered, unfiltered. And that's how you can talk about it intelligently. And it's also how you can learn, in my opinion, how natural can a wine be. Is the only way for a wine to be natural is the winemaker just leaves it, never does anything to it, and you end up with oxidized vinegar. You know, where do we draw the line on natural? Like, I would say natural wine people have got to understand that for the most part, wines need a very little bit of sulfur, a little bit, much less than they were using over the years. All the unsulfured wines I've imported, only one of them was 100% consistent, and that was from the guy who launched the movement, Jules Chauvet, in the Beaujolais. That's where Marcel Lapierre learned, was from Jules. I imported three vintages from Jules Chauvet before he died, and they had no sulfur. And there were never any off aromas. It never started re-fermenting in the bottle. It didn't oxidize. It wouldn't go through periods where it stank to high heaven. That's the only one. Now, what's happened that I can't agree with is people are going to say, put their nose in the glass, oh, that stinks. Oh, wow, that's a natural wine. Oh, yeah. You know, I'm seeing that happen. It's become such a religious experience that you have to have faith, you know. The thing that most people don't know is hardly anyone in the world, I can't even name anybody, has made the experience so many wines, the same wine filtered and unfiltered. How can anybody talk about that and have an opinion about it if they don't do those tastings? And nobody's done those tastings. That's as simple as that. I started seeing that the wines I was tasting out of barrel had certain qualities that weren't there in bottle. And I found out why. They were filtered. And filtering takes a lot out of a wine, even a light filtration. I heard that a lot. Oh, we just do a light filtration. But I made the comparison. Okay, I'm going to compare your light filtration with the same wine. So a lot of wineries started bottling for me unfiltered, but the rest of their wines were filtered. So again, I had that chance to compare the two. Now I've had the chance to taste 20-year-old wines. The same wine, filtered and unfiltered. So I know what I'm talking about. I see the difference. You can see the difference in the color. You can smell the difference. A filtered wine is dead long before an unfiltered wine. Wow, that's important, isn't it? It's important to me. See these little wine shops that, with their individual collections, you know, they're not all trying to buy the same wines, and I love that. That's what I like to see. It's when I go to buy wines, I like to see all these little domains. Each one has a wine that's different. I like small business. I hate the fact that in France and the United States now, it's all big business, and when you go to work for somebody else for slave wages, and you do work like at a cash register. I mean, we don't even have cash registers anymore, but I just can't stand the way this is changing. And what have I seen now in New York? What are there, two chains of drugstores now? I mean, why don't we have thousands of individually owned drugstores? I hate that. That's not what I call capitalism. That's what I call monopoly. I wasn't ambitious, you know, to buy a big store or anything like that. The thing was, I wish I'd been able to sell her some of those great California wines that I was tasting from the 60s and early 70s. I mean, some Beaulieu Cabernets, some Inglenooks, and Louis Martini Cabernet and Barbera were just incredible wines that aged beautifully and weren't expensive. I would have put a bunch of them away. I liked the Heights. Martha's Vineyard Cabernet in those days was a marvel, Maya Camas. I didn't have the money to sell her those, and that I really regret, because it seems to me that California wines have changed a lot since then. In those days, they were made with grapes at more like 12 degrees alcohol, and that's certainly not the case today. They were very balanced. They showed a lot of finesse. They showed a lot of terroir. I shouldn't judge. I don't taste enough. But when I do taste something, it's more like made to a formula to me. It's like how much oak, you know, just the right amount of oak, and how much alcohol, and everything's. I don't get that individuality that I used to get out of California wines. And my son, who's 23 and just started work for me, he tells me that things are happening quickly now, and the pendulum's moving there too. Uh, I don't think much about being remembered because I'm totally of the opinion that when I'm dead, I won't be around to enjoy how people remember me. So I'm just going to do what I want to do while I'm alive.
Currently, Kermit Lynch and his wife divide their time between Berkeley and Provence, France. He continues to make music and import some of the finest wines in the world. This program was produced by Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee for HeritageRadioNetwork.org, with additional research by Sari Kamen. In order of appearance, the songs used in this piece are Devil's Trail by Brothers NYC, Carolina Peach by the California Honey Drops, Asleep by Jerome LOL, Beliefs Are Free by P. Villa, What Now by Jerome LOL, Battle Royale by Rectech, It's Cold and Beautiful by Magical Mistakes, and once again Devil's Trail by Brothers NYC.